Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 19, delivered on October 31, 2017. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. I'll begin with some informal terminology here to distinguish two types of risk: common versus independent. Take this one. The probability, you're going to live in Florida. And so the probability of a hurricane coming and slapping your house around and tossing it into North Carolina is, say, 1%. You, madam, live in a safe state, Illinois. Okay? Very quiet state. Now, you don't have to worry about hurricanes, but you do have to worry about the occasional theft of stuff from your house. They break in and they steal your collection of Elvis plates. I know, right? Seriously. Now, the probability of that happening to you is 1% as well. So in any given year, there is a 99% chance that you won't have your house spread around a few states. And there's a 99% chance that you won't have that precious Elvis collection of plates taken away, okay, by just bad people. Bad people do that. They're clowns. They're midget clowns. And they do that kind of thing. It's a gang of clowns. They want Elvis plates. Okay, now, understand that in each of these cases, there's only a 1% chance that it would happen in any given year, this big problem. However, there's a difference in insuring the two of you, because the insurance that I would put on you, if there is a claim against you, sir, with living in Florida on the coast, that claim would happen to a whole lot of people. They would be filing claims at the same time. With you, what are those midget clowns going to do? They rob every place in the entire city of Decatur? No, I think not. So the difference is that you face what your risk is a common risk. It is common to everyone around you, so that if one person gets hit, everyone gets hit. That's like an earthquake, or a meteor strike, or a nuclear attack from North Korea hitting your place. But yours is independent risk. It would be independent. You live in another neighborhood nearby. They're probably not going to hit your house, too. They got what they wanted there, and they leave. So the difference here is a common risk, all are exposed to it. Independent risk, not all are exposed to it at the same time. And I want to put that underneath both of them. At the same time. This is important. In business, for example, a downturn in the economy that would hit every company would be a common risk. But you run a business and you just happen to screw up a project and it turned out to be a disaster. So at the same time, you run a business, you wouldn't have had that same problem at that time. So you can point, that was a stupid idea. Later, you're going to do something stupid, but not at the same time will it likely happen. So understand that that kind of business risk is independent. One business is going down, the other one's doing okay. And then some other business does bad and other businesses are doing okay. Those are independent risks. The common risks would be like interest rates are beginning to rise, and that would cause all businesses to begin to change their investment patterns, their project decision-making results, and all of that. So this is important for us to understand that there are some risks that we do concern ourselves with. Those are the risks for which where we expect a return on investments, when we take those kinds of risks. But these independent risks, they should be able to cancel each other out to a large extent. One business doing bad, the other business doing good. And so over time, if you have enough businesses that you are investing in, these independent risks will cancel each other out. But this is the crucial part about portfolios. You buy a single stock, you are going to be exposed to all of the risks, common and independent of the business behind that stock. But if you are investing in a bunch of stocks, they will cancel each other's independent risks out. And all that will be left under the surface is that common risk. To give you an example, I thought this one was in your textbook, but maybe it's not. A company like Microsoft, if you invest in that company on its own, you are the overall risk to which you are exposed is 60% Microsoft itself. And only 40% of it is common risk. So if you were to put Microsoft into a portfolio of many companies, 60% of the volatility of that stock would go away. It would just not be there because it would get canceled out by other stocks at the same time. And I believe I showed you this one before. And I'm going to pull up a quick... I should have done this before the class started, but I want to show you a place where you can, not now, quit it. I want to show you a place where you can look at how much risk companies have in common with each other, as opposed to how much they cancel each other out. Market return... And I wish I could. Let me make this a little larger so you can see it. I can't bookmark things here, so I'm looking at Portfolio Visualizer. There's where it is. There's mine. Now, if I were to take a couple of companies, let's say Target, Kroger, Home Depot. Anyone else got anything? Amazon, AMZN. And a few others I could throw in there. I don't know. Let's put in Aon. Walmart. What's Walmart? I should have looked these up before I did this. This will be enough. And I'm going to look at start date. Let's take it back way, 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 way back, okay? Just over a long haul. Let's say November 1 of 2011. To the present, October 30th of this year. And we'll use daily returns and a 60-day running on it. Okay, now, let me make this a little bigger. This, by the way, when you are building a portfolio, You can't, it doesn't hurt to look at correlations among securities in the portfolio. The lower the correlation, the more they are going to cancel each other's risk, that independent risk out. So, for example, if I were to look at Kroger against Target, do you see that that correlation is actually fairly strong? They're both consumer, consumable goods, things like that. So there's more a stronger correlation. Notice that Home Depot and Target are even more correlated. They are both stores where you go to buy things that are for the home and all that. On the other hand, Amazon against Target, they are very poorly correlated. That means that putting them together in a portfolio, they would do a lot more to cancel out each other's independent risk. And that's a good thing. And looking around here, 23, Aon, which is a reinsurer against Kroger, they don't have a whole lot in common. So, yeah, their correlation coefficients are going to be fairly low. And that's one of the ways that you build a good portfolio is to identify stocks that do have low correlation coefficients because they will more efficiently dampen out that independent risk that each has. Now, over here, these terms that I used here, common and independent, and this, by the way, is important in insurance. It's hugely important, especially in health insurance, because the larger the pool of people that we put into an insurance pool, the more likely they will cancel out each other's independent risks. You two might be very much alike, but when you get diabetes, she won't. When you, madam, break your leg, you won't. When you get pregnant, he won't. It can happen. I mean, you're muttering. Okay, now. when you have your first heart attack, she won't. When you, madam, have your first nervous breakdown, he won't. He has his later. Yeah, during middle age crisis. When he looks in the mirror and he finally realizes, nope. You see, so as we put more people into an insurance pool, and especially the more we diversify the types of insurance. One thing that insurers had in their minds for a long, long time was, we're going to cherry pick. We're going to pick the lowest risk people. And they think, well, that's going to get our insurance payouts down. Actually, that's not the best idea. Getting the most diversity in the pool is a much better way to kill off the independent risk. You see, if I am cherry picking only young, professional, Caucasian, high-paid, upstanding young studs like you, I'm going to put all those people in the pool. They're going to have a common risk that's going to whip it up. All of them are going to have the same problems at the same time. That's not the best idea in the world. I mean, you go after different people who are going to have exposures at different times and different types of exposures. That's a much better way to cancel out risk. The same happens when you hear these choirs oftentimes, is that if you heard one of those voices singing on its own, oh God, that sucks. But when you put them in combination with all the other people who have oddities in their voices, can't sing, hold a note, you get a pretty awesome kind of a song. At Christmas time, you'll hear these giant audiences all singing Handel's Messiah, and it sounds phenomenal. And that's just because everyone is canceling out each other's bad voices or modulations or whatever. This is the basic principle of portfolio diversification. It happens, it's common to the entire universe that the more you put in of different kinds, the more they will cancel out each other's unusual patterns. And so we come to the next term, which is to use a different word. Instead of common risk, we call in finance, we call this systematic risk because it is in the system itself, systematic risk, as opposed to non-systematic risk, which is not in the system. It's in the individual companies, in the individual stocks themselves. Excuse me. Now, there's another term for this, too, I want to bring up. Systematic, you'll hear me use the term non-diversifiable. In other words, I can't diversify the portfolio and get rid of it. It's in there. It's embedded. It's metastatic. It is the core why we invest. As opposed to non-systematic risk, which we call diversifiable. Because you can get rid of it by diversification of the portfolio. Now, by the way, these are incredibly great terms to look for you to answer, to define on an exam. I'm not saying that I do that, but I do that. Well, you see that, yes, the non-diversifiable and the diversifiable, systematic and non-systematic, those all could be part of a question. Well, it's not four. It's actually more than that. But I've said, what is non-diversifiable risk? And I get an answer, that's risk that is not diversifiable. No, that's when I break out the single malt and drink some of it before I start grading. No, you got to give me something better than that. Systematic, it's in the system. No, you give me, explain it better than that. Non-diversifiable risk is risk that cannot be removed or eliminated by increasing the number of stocks in the portfolio. Non-diversifiable risk is risk that cannot be removed by increasing the number of stocks in the portfolio. Diversifiable risk is risk that can be removed and eliminated. Now, a couple of things here. How many stocks would it take to get down to the core, to the very core common risk? That would be theoretically all you'd have to have every company in the every stock in the economy weighted its weight in the portfolio would have to be the same as the company's market cap weight in the entire world economy. I mean, it ain't going to happen. The market portfolio, as we call it, is just a theoretical. We can't really get to it. We can get close to it. And in 341, I actually show some of the ways that you can get awfully close to it through some portfolio structuring that you can do. But realistically, the way we get to it, first of all, to get rid of about 95% of the diversifiable risk, you would want 30 stocks in the portfolio, about 30. And you would want to go through and look at the correlations to make sure that you weren't getting high correlation stocks, because that's not going to help you much. So about 30 will shake out a lot. But 30 is actually a surprisingly large number. To buy 30 different stocks, you're going to be talking about a lot of transactions costs and monitoring. You're going to have to keep your eye on them somewhat. It gets to be actually quite difficult to create your own well-diversified portfolio. Now, on your own, you don't need to worry about this. If you want to buy one stock or two stocks and ride the pony, sure, go ahead. It's when you are looking at it from a larger perspective than just yourself. It's not just, well, if you're a financial planner or if you're a stock advisor. It really goes down to also what happens when you start to have a family and all of that. Because then those independent risks, those diversifiable risks, you're not impacting just yourself by bearing risk like that. You're impacting people around you by doing that. So when you're young and you're on your own, yeah, just invest in a stock or two. It's your loss or your gain. But when you get to a larger responsibility, either to your family or to clients, that's when you have to get serious about doing things right and getting rid of as much common risk, as much independent risk as you can in your portfolio. Interestingly, though, when I talk about common risk, I brought this up earlier. A few years ago, I took finance students up to one of the big heavy-duty reinsurance companies in Chicagoland, Zurich. And they did a great presentation, marketed, invited people to apply for jobs and all that kind of stuff. And there was a question and answer period, and there was one of the students at the time said, weren't you guys hit pretty hard with the Fukushima disaster? That was the nuclear power plant meltdown in Japan. And because Zurich did have a position as one of the reinsurers in that fiasco. And they were quite ready to acknowledge, yeah, we were hit hard. In other words, independent risk. They were the ones who can't get rid of the independent risk. Oh, but they could. And they quickly commented after they said, yes, we were hit bad with that. However, fortunately, nuclear power plant disasters don't happen everywhere at the same time, and we did very well in other parts of the world where we were insuring things like that, and it didn't happen. So even in something as dramatic and large scale as a nuclear disaster, there are ways that you can diversify your portfolio to get rid of the at least some of that independent risk. Yeah, they were hit, but at the same time, they were hit there, but they weren't hit in hundreds of other places where they insure nuclear reactors or they are participate in reinsurance of nuclear reactors. So it gives you an idea that even when you're thinking about independent risks, we are able, in this world we have today, to globalize risk to the point where, yeah, even the U.S. economy going tap city, well, you can invest, put some of your holdings in stocks of countries other than the United States. So a downturn in the United States would not happen at the same time as, say, a downturn in Asia. So even what we used to think might be exposures we just have to wear, we don't have to anymore in this world where we can buy and sell risk of all kinds all across the globe. And eventually, in your lifetimes, we will even begin to be able to increase the level of diversification into operations in outer space, in orbit, on asteroids, possibly in your lifetimes, definitely the moon in your lifetimes. So the portfolio diversification is just going to get beyond even the global aspect of it as we spread civilizations out into the interplanetary environment. So there you go. Kind of a little bit of not science fiction anymore stuff to talk about in business. Okay. What's a mother to do here? Here, let me bring up something real quick here. Get this in your notes, for heaven's sakes. How do you diversify a portfolio when in your small capacities, my small capacity, we can't really afford to be buying 30, 50, 100 different stocks? We can still do it. And there are a couple of ways that you can. First of all, how to have a diversified portfolio. Well, I told you the first way. Buy 30 or more stocks with low correlation coefficients. Now, I showed you this place, and I'll put up a link to this, too, on my podcasting site in the scrolling marquee. This is called the Portfolio Visualizer, portfoliovisualizer.com/asset-correlations. Again, portfoliovisualizer, all one word, .com/asset-correlations. You can push in all as many stocks as you want, and you'll get a nice correlation matrix out of it that can guide you. And I strongly recommend that if you're going to build your own portfolio, do this. And what's the rule of thumb? Okay, I have my rule of thumb is I avoid correlations above 0.3. Now, you might remember from your stats course, correlation coefficients, they can go up to 1. I recommend correlation coefficients below 0.3. Another thing, and this is something that I say emphatically when I am in upper-level finance courses, don't buy stocks just because you like the company or you've heard great things about the company. Be objective. Well, I shop at Target, so I'm going to buy Target stock. Or I hate Walmart, so I won't buy Walmart. Or this company isn't green, so I won't buy this company because it's not Mother Earth friendly. Don't do that, because that's going to bias your portfolio. Buy stocks objectively. Hell, if you have to, just roll the dice and pick a stock. But, well, don't do that. Do your research, obviously, but don't let personal feelings about companies. Well, my friend works for this company, and she says it's a really great company and all this. No, don't. Look at companies objectively, not just because you shop there or because you've heard good things about their employee policies or whatever. Unless it's something that you can truly and objectively include in your analysis of the company's ability to generate shareholder wealth. Don't. I mean, I shop at Target. I like to. People look at me funny when I go in there. I shop at Walmart, too, because people don't look at me funny in there. I feel at home with the people in there. No, seriously. I mean, think about it. I've seen you in there. I mean, good heavens. Yeah. Well, it must have been someone who looked like you. He was wearing a very kicky pair of shorts. Okay? Now, but that's strong advice from someone who's a professional, who's been a professional in the industry. Don't let your personal feelings get involved too much unless you can justify, well, my experience is good at this store. That doesn't mean everyone's experience is good at that store. Or I've heard that this company's coming out with a new product. Wonderful. Analyze the product. Don't analyze the hype. Because a lot of what happens with new products is just pure hype. The same with movies. Oh, this is going to be the blockbuster of the year. Nah, not really. You look at the objective analysis. What are large numbers of potential moviegoers saying about this? Good example of a movie that was hyped to the max very recently, and it bombed. It's a bomb. Is Blade Runner 2049. Other ones that were disasters on the screen or not disasters on the screen. Look at how the objective overall appearance of them looks, and that goes for movie studios too. Are they generating one blockbuster after another? Have you heard good things about them? Wonderful. Look at how their performance is. Two, Now, these two right here, 2 and 3, are different ways to do a trick to get portfolio diversification. You can buy mutual funds. Now, a mutual fund is an investment in a portfolio of securities. It could be stocks, it could be bonds, it could be both. But it is a large number of them. The mutual fund managers have market power to be able to acquire large numbers of shares or bonds of many different companies. And therefore, through that method, they are able to achieve portfolio diversification, and you can buy into these funds. Good things about them: the fund managers are maintaining the balance of the portfolios. A second good thing is that with many mutual funds, they reinvest the dividends that come out back into the fund. So that it essentially is adding a multiplier effect to your investment over time. The third, which is, okay, a good and a bad, is that you can find mutual funds that are targeted to specific sectors, to specific industries, to specific management styles, for heaven's sakes, even. You can buy a mutual fund that invests only in stocks that are of companies that are highly interested in conservation and efficiency and the Mother Earth thing and all that. You can buy stocks that are of high technology. You can buy mutual funds that invest only in high technology companies. You can buy mutual funds that invest in companies all over the world, high diversification globally. Now, when you're buying mutual funds, you want to make sure that you buy either no load or low load. In other words, they're not going to charge you any fee, or they're going to charge you a very modest fee to join the game. Don't be buying, well, this stock does really well, but they want all this money for me to become an investor. Well, you're going to wipe out any earnings that way. Okay, the next thing is that, okay, here's the downside of mutual funds, is that you can switch mutual funds only a limited number of times per year. 4 would probably be about it. So even if you're in a mutual fund and you don't think that mutual fund's going to be doing very well because of something that's happened in the country or something like that, or that industry, you can't just go online, well, I'm going to get out of this one and get to this one. Okay? You can't do that. You have to wait 4 times. You've got windows where you can do your swapping out. That's the downside, is that there are a limited number of trading opportunities per year. That is not the case, of course, with one where you manage your own portfolio completely, and it won't be the case with 3 that I show you here in just a minute. Mutual funds are actually a good investment choice for people. However, let me give you a couple of pieces of advice. First of all, you can look at the beta. You can look at the risk of your mutual and shape your portfolio to your risk preferences, your mutual fund. But I would strongly recommend that you don't buy just one mutual fund. You would invest in a couple of mutual funds at least. Now, again, I'm taking you a little bit beyond this class here, but this is not investment advice. I'm just telling you this is a good idea, and you have to consider me, whether I really do have good ideas or not. Think carefully about that before you start following my advice. I have regrets, many. Anyway, here's one way you could do it, is you would go three mutual funds. One would be a stock mutual fund, an equity fund, where they invest in stocks. Something that, you know, you can choose your beta, something maybe a little aggressive, a 1.1, 1.2, 1.4 beta. And then you would also invest in some money into a bond fund. Something that was cautious, conservative, defensive. And then you would invest in a cash fund. A cash fund, when I use the word cash, when we use the word cash in finance, oftentimes what we're talking about is money in that is in either a money market fund of some kind or in just treasuries. So when I say a cash fund, you would probably be looking at a mutual fund that invested in government security, government bonds, okay? And then what you would do is when you perceive through your analysis, not through your gut, but through your analysis, your minds, that the economy was doing well, you might do something like 80% equity, maybe 15% bonds, and 5% cash fund. And then as you saw the economy maybe turning against stocks or something like that, you would, in an intermediate period, you might go to 60%, 30%, and then 10% on the cash fund. And then if the economy begins to really look like it's going to seriously turn down, you might pull back to 40 or something even lower than that, maybe 30%, 55%, 30% in the equity fund, 55% in the bond fund, and then 15% in cash. Some pattern like that. You've got to have your own sense of how you want to allocate. You notice that even when the economy is beginning to kind of lose its way, in my judgment, you would still want to stay in the equity funds as for a while anyway. And then at your next trading opportunity, if it looked like it was turning south seriously, get the hell out of the stocks. Flight to quality. Remember what I said about that? You run away from the... But you don't run away at the first sign of trouble. That's not the way you should do it. And when someone predicts, well, the economy is going to go to hell next month, no, look at it for yourself. Listen to other experts, bears and bulls. But if it does look like all hell's going to break loose, get out of the equity funds, fly to the quality, and also increase your cash reserve as well. Now, you see that mutual funds can satisfy the needs of many investors. They are not perfect because, again, you can't trade out whenever you want. You're going to have to ride the dog for a while here until you have a window when you can make your swap move away from it. But there are all kinds of great funds out there, and in a subsequent lecture, I'll show you how to look up mutual funds, analyze them, see what's right for you. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it true that, say, you're going to do your long-term investment mutual fund or the 401k, if you're in the equity funds, when the prices drop, you get more shares for the same amount of money, and then it goes back up, isn't it?
Okay, I'm going to get to that in a minute here. Yeah, you're talking about dollar averaging. Yeah, dollar averaging is a trading strategy, and I'm going to bring that up here, and just. You stayed?
Oh, yeah.
Did you? Okay, you wrote it out, right? And you're okay now, right? Sure. It's the people who ran away. They see, when the stock market took its dive in 2008, it was going down, way down, handball on the curb. I mean, it was just really low. And the people who freaked out and bailed, well, of course, they bailed at low, low prices, lost everything. And then when the market recovered, they bought back in when the prices had already come back up. They lost. The people who just wrote it out just said, okay, it was on paper then, it's on paper now. They did just fine coming out of that stock market crash and the Great Recession. It was the people who lost their water and ran. It's just like in combat. Your first job with the enemy is to cause them so much confusion that they lose their discipline and they scatter. Then you can kill them very effectively. But I shouldn't be talking like this to you guys. Sorry. Just I have flashbacks there. I felt good there for a second. But seriously, in so many different parts of your lives, holding your water, staying frosty, is the best way to proceed. That's why when I say, unless you really see all hell breaking loose, stay in the game. Stay in the game. If you weren't going to have that kind of difficulty, it wouldn't be a game. And everything should be a game until the one where they're pointing the bullet at you. And then it gets kind of serious. That's this scenario right there. Okay, now there's another one. This is actually a stock. It's a share of stock. It's an equity. But it's called an ETF, an electronically traded fund. These are stocks that are actually representing giant indexes of stocks. In other words, you buy this stock, and what's behind it, and this is not exactly how it works, but basically you're buying the stock of a company that is nothing but an investment in a massive portfolio, diversified portfolio. You can buy ETFs for all the Dow, Standard & Poor's 500. Let me show you one right here. I'll show you something right here. Let me go to Yahoo Finance and I'll get this one up here. Finance.yahoo.com. Yeah. An ETF is a security that represents a portfolio of securities. An ETF is a security that represents a portfolio of securities. Now, that's not a full definition, but that'll be close enough for us here. That's not. Let me show you one here. SPY. Spiders. They're crawling all over the place. That's a Standard & Poor's 500. You can buy 500 separate stocks in one stock. You can buy it and sell it anytime, day or night. You, madam, ate a bad pizza at 11 p.m. You wake up at 2 o'clock with heartburn and think, I need to do some stock trading. It's happened to me. I mean, it happens to all of us. And Bad pizza. Okay, you can call up and trade your stock, trade your spider. Okay? You can't do that with a mutual fund. You call them up at 2 a.m., the mutual fund manager, he's going to say, what the hell are you calling me for at this hour? Your window doesn't open until next month. But you can with an ETF. I mean, I'm your broker. I too ate a bad pizza. Okay? Everything on it. Little did I know when they said everything, they meant everything. You ever had a pizza with anchovies? You know, those little fishies? Oh, that's nasty. And those people who eat pizza with pineapple on it, they are wrong. Seriously. That's just... Anyway. I had a sushi pizza. My God, that was bad. Where the hell was... Oh, okay. ETF. Here's one here. Spiders. Spiders crawling all over the place. Now, to buy a round lot... Now, a round lot, again, is 100 shares of a stock. A round lot of this would be rather pricey. But you can buy ETFs for different indexes. Now, the Standard & Poor's, what was the number I saw? If you hold the Standard & Poor's 500 index, you hold, I think, about 70% of the market cap of the world, or something like that. So that's a serious attempt at diversification right there. You put a couple of these different ETFs together, different indices, and you would have a very close to market portfolio. And this is something else. This was another point. I'm showing you a couple of the things that I do in higher level classes. We can't buy the market portfolio. It's a theoretical thing, and it would just be insanely. However, we do know that what's called a portfolio of portfolios, about four different portfolios, each of which is widely diversified, they come very close, I mean mathematically close, if you do it right, to the actual theoretical market portfolio. So you can actually almost simulate a purely diversified market portfolio. And then you can use leverage with T-bill, with a mutual fund of T-bills or something like that, to back in and out from that on the cap on the securities market line. So in other words, you could replicate any beta you wanted with a portfolio of portfolios, like Spider and a couple of others. But anyway, here's one of them, the Spider. And they're very cool. Here's the upside. Again, you can buy and sell them at will. You can get out, get in, anytime, day or night. But the downside is that you pay the transactions cost. You know, you're going to pay every time you do a trade in stocks or bonds, you pay a commission. So with the mutual fund, you don't pay a commission, but you have a limited number of opportunities to rebalance your portfolio. With the ETFs, you have unlimited trading freedom, but that is at the cost of the commissions per trade. You're just buying stocks. Basically, these are just stocks. You could call your broker and say, one round lot SPY at market, and she would know exactly what to do. Buy 100 shares at $257.25. You did it right now. So it's actually kind of a cool thing, these ETFs are. If you want to play in the stock market, see, some people don't like mutual funds because there's no fun in there. Well, there is. You research these mutual funds. You see what their behavior is. You look at the manager's track record. But with these, I mean, you're right in the game. You're trading stocks, except you're not trading individual companies. You're trading indexes of stocks. But they are stocks, just like any others. So, also, one last thing, and I'm not going to hold you to this, but if you want to invest in foreign companies, now, a foreign company cannot, and I've brought this up, but I'm going to formally bring it up now. foreign companies cannot directly list on the stock, on a U.S. stock exchange. However, you can buy ADRs, American Depository Receipts, which are essentially an asset, a security backed by the actual stock of that foreign company. The ADR will trade on a U.S. exchange, but it represents stock of a company overseas, in France, Germany, wherever. So ADRs are something that you can use if you're going to go your own road there, building your own portfolio, and you want to globalize it, which is a good idea oftentimes for portfolio diversification. You would go with ADRs to do that part. Don't invest just in overseas companies. But at the same time, if you want to add that flavor to your portfolio structure, ADRs are what you would want to use for. How are you doing on this? This is actually... A lot of what I'm doing in this lecture is practical advice. You might not want to use it now. You might not be able to use it now. But as you had mentioned earlier, once you have your your pension plan or your retirement plan in place, a lot of them are self-managed these days. You can decide what you want to do. And a lot of them will allow you to invest in mutual funds. And they'll give you this large array. Now, mutual funds, one thing you have to know is that there are different companies that offer their own inventory of mutual funds. TIAA, CREF, Vanguard, what's some other ones I'm trying to think of? Yeah, there are like dozens and dozens of them. And within each company's inventory, there are all kinds of different opportunities. Bond funds, capital gains, dividend funds, funds that give a lot of dividends, high growth, mid-range cap, middle-range capitalization companies, special situations companies are something that you'll see sometimes. In other words, the mutual fund is always looking for companies that are about to have something big happen, and they invest in those. When the stock price goes up, then they sell out. So there are all kinds of different tricks that you can, or ways that you can invest. And these are listed. You can type in the trading symbol of a mutual fund, and I'll do that next time for you. And you'll see a beta, so you can shape your portfolio to your risk preferences. You'll see all kinds of information about the company's performance historically. Now, let me show you something interesting here. I'm going to bring up... I've always shown you the front screen on Yahoo. Now let me show you a back screen, historical data. This allows you to actually download this. You can download this and then proceed to go through and look at its performance over time. You can also go in and profile. I said profile. Oh. Profile. Is there some reason that sucks? Never trust a company that's called Yahoo for anything. That's not what I was expecting to see. Oh, it's a spider. I see, yeah. So it won't do it. Okay, something back up here. Let me back this up. I want you to notice something about the spider. Look at its beta. Look at its beta. Do you notice something unusual about that beta? That is exactly the market portfolio's beta, 1.00, right on the fulcrum of leverage. So in other words, you are essentially getting the beta of 1.0 that you always dreamed of, the market portfolio's beta, right there in that spider. And there's another one. Let me show you one real quick here. Here's a bond fund. Sorry. Look at that mother, that thing, okay? That has a beta of 1.01. I like this subject, okay? Hey, don't judge me. But look at that. That's a bond fund. So there you go. Look, you can actually create a bond fund on an ETF. Yeah. Say that again?
Would mortgage-backed securities be considered an ETF, or are they different?
No, don't. No, no. Those are, no, no. That's like saying, is a Kit Kat candy bar the same as black licorice? No. Black licorice was created by Satan.
So it's a mortgage-backed security.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's that. Look. Look at that. But do you see? You can actually do bonds. You can do stocks with ETFs. They are actually a great thing. Just don't go trading happy. If you're going to eat pizza, make sure your mobile phone isn't charged, okay? Because that means that when you wake up and have a bad case of heartburn, you can't call your broker. Because otherwise it's almost fun to trade these because you know you're maintaining. See, if you're buying and selling stocks, having fun with that, you're throwing your portfolio's balance all out of whack. Every time you do it, whack, whack, whack. With these, as you buy and sell them, You're not unbalancing a portfolio because these are balanced portfolios. And if there's an axiom, you don't have to write this one down unless you get to my 341 class. A portfolio of efficient portfolios is an efficient portfolio. So in other words, since these are efficient portfolios, if I put these portfolios together into a portfolio, the resulting portfolio is efficient. That sounds like it's almost trivial, but it's kind of an important point. You can play with ETFs. Build a portfolio of maybe 5 ETFs, and then you can move them back and forth like that, and you can still maintain balance in your portfolio. Last thing, you want to do your own stock trading. Is that so? Okay. Let's do a couple of old investment tricks. I'll start with the one you suggested. Dollar averaging. You got a certain amount. You make sure that you have a certain amount of money you're going to put into the stock market or into the bond market, whatever, every month. You don't change how much you invest every month just because stock prices change. Because you see, if you've got, let's say, $1,000 you're going to put in every month, when stock prices go down, that means your $1,000 buys more shares. When stock prices are high, that $1,000 will not buy very many shares. The result is that you are doing the old almost a comical rule, buy low, sell high. Use a fixed dollar investment. That's the more fancier term for it. Fixed dollar investment month over month. If you had done that during the crash of 2008, you would literally be a millionaire if you had held your water and just kept buying in as the market went down. You would have been buying more and more shares of stock at the lower and lower prices. So when the stock market rose back up, you'd have a ton of shares rising with the market. That's fixed dollar investing or dollar averaging. Another one that's harder to achieve. I tell you all the time, don't look at the accounting numbers, the financial tell you accounting stuff. But there are some things in accounting information that are perhaps inadvertently useful. The book value of the equity. Wrong one. The book value of the equity. Let me show you one here. I'm going to go to sec.gov. And I'm going to go to filings. Just to remind you, company filings. Oops. Search for company filings. Seriously? Come on. What happened there? What did I do wrong? Company filing search. I must have clicked the wrong thing. And just for, because I brought up Target, I'll bring up Target again. And let me find the 10K. Interactive data. And I'm going to just look at something really quick here. Consolidated balance sheets. Why am I having a hard time seeing the balance sheet? Nope. Really? Balance sheet. Okay. What I'm talking about here is shareholder, total stockholder, shareholders' investment. It's what it's called here. This is the book value of Target's equity. $10,953,000,000. Now, going back to Yahoo Finance. There's the market cap, $32 billion. This is what the market says the company is worth. This is what the accounting statements say the company is worth. The market says that the company is worth $32.3 billion. The book value is 10.9. That means that the market to book for this company is about 3.2. 32 billion divided by 11 billion. Okay? Now, that has accounting data in it. But you see this number right here? This is like the baby. This is what it looks like before it becomes enhanced. This is you still wrapped in your placenta. This is you with your umbilical cord still attached. I wish you'd get rid of it. At the beach, that's really freaking out people. Okay. You see, it's almost like the infant appearance of the child company before the market begins to make its assessment of it. So when I look at the market to book, what I'm looking at is how much the company has grown since it was a child. In a market to book, in other words, the market says this company is now worth $32 billion. In its pure raw form, the amount of money it raised through selling stock, the amount of accounting profit it makes, that is the book value. So in this case, the market to book is, I don't remember what I did there, 3.2, something like that, 3.2. What you do to build a portfolio, you check stocks to make sure they're low correlation. And then what you do is you lay out maybe 100 stocks and then list them in terms of their market to book for highest to lowest. And what you do is you choose the 30 highest market to books. And then every year, you look at them again, get 100 stocks, put your 30 in there, but look again. And any of your 30 that aren't in the top 30 here in the new look, you kick out and put in the ones that something that is in the top 30. This is a constant every year. You just cycle through your stocks to look for the ones that have the biggest market to books. Another one that is used is called the momentum portfolio. The momentum portfolio is actually pretty easy to think about. You look at the stocks in terms of their gain over the last year. And then what you do is you look at the ones that have the highest returns over that past year. You throw out the ones that are below the average, and you move in a new group of stocks that are above, I'm sorry, the median. You throw out the 15 lowest, and you replace them with 15 that have a higher momentum. In other words, every year, what you're doing is you're looking at your return over the last year of your 30, 40, 50 stocks, whatever. You clean out the lowest 15 in return, and then you replace those with stocks that are within the band of the 15 that are remaining, like this. You've got your 30 stocks right here. Every year, you look at their returns, and the 15 lowest you get rid of and put in 15 more that are in the range of your performance on the top 15. That's called the momentum portfolio. And the reason I'm telling you these, because they really aren't not all that nice theoretically, but they work. Empirically, in other words, with actual real-world results, we know that these tricks, and they really are tricks, really do create good returns. But you have to manage your portfolio. You have to do this. You can't, this year I won't do it, because you could get creamed if you just leave your portfolio sitting there. So I've given you the dollar averaging, or the fixed dollar investment strategy. I've given you the one that is using market to book, the market to book portfolio strategy. And then this last one is called the momentum strategy. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.